Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America, designed for people like you who are learning American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. Every day of the year on this program, we bring you news from and about the United States and the world. Because this program is produced for learners of American English, like you, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words and phrases that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. This is what you will hear on today's program. We will tell you the story of three fatherless, abandoned Vietnamese Americans searching for their families. Correspondent Ann Ball will tell us the latest on efforts to find signs of life on Mars. And as we do every Monday, we will present The Making of a Nation. Today, we will tell you about the 1960 presidential election. Senator John F. Kennedy faced Vice President Richard Nixon. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. So let's get started. Here are Brian Lynn and Kelly Jean Kelly with the story about three abandoned Vietnamese Americans searching for their fathers.
Moki, Tom, and Janie's were babies at the close of the American War in Vietnam in the 1970s. Their mothers were Vietnamese. Their fathers were American soldiers. In one way or another, they were all abandoned. Now the search for their birth families has brought them together. Here are their stories.
Moki was at an orphanage in Vietnam when her adopted mother saw her. Maria Eitz was single, but she had already taken in two mixed-race Vietnamese boys. Now she wanted her sons to have a sister. After all, Eitz knew what it was like to be an orphan. She was left in Germany without her parents at the end of World War II. The women who worked at the Khun Tha orphanage tried to show Eitz some mixed-race babies with light skin. But Eitz saw only a dark-skinned girl with a big stomach and curly hair. "That's my daughter," Eitz said. She wanted a girl who looked like her two black Vietnamese adopted sons. And, she said, she wanted a girl whom nobody else wanted. Eitz named her daughter Moki and brought her to San Francisco, California, where she and her sons lived.
"I remember being very happy as a kid," Moki said. Her house was full of other children. Her adopted mother eventually married a kind, respectful man. Moki attended a good school and had close friends. Still, Moki thought about finding her biological parents. She imagined they had a love story. Their romance was like a fairy tale, she thought, like the show Miss Saigon.
When she was 18 years old, Moki herself became pregnant. Even at that young age, she was excited to have her own child. "I wanted my own blood," Moki explained. She gave birth to a daughter, Caitlin, in 1992. The following year, Moki found a growth on Caitlin's neck. She brought her daughter to the doctor. But she could not tell the doctor her family's medical history. Moki thought, "This is my child, and I don't know what's wrong. And the doctors don't seem to know what's wrong. And I have no information." The thought scared her. Now she had to find her biological parents. The search was a medical necessity.
Tom did not have as happy a childhood as Moki did. When he was 3 days old, someone left him in a box outside a bar. Many American soldiers spent time at the bar, located just outside Tuy Huan Air Base, near the city of Nha Chan. Whoever left the baby was telling the American soldiers that the boy belonged to one of them, but none of the men claimed the baby. So the bar's owner, Win Tae Nguyen Vun, adopted him. She called him Win Tum and raised him as her only son. When Tum was only 11 years old, Nguyen Vun left. She went with a boyfriend to Pleiku. Tum stayed with his adopted grandparents. But Tum remembers his adopted grandparents did not welcome him. "You don't belong here," his grandmother said. "Any day you are here, you have to work for the food you eat."
In the late 1980s, a Vietnamese official came to talk to Tum's grandparents. The official explained that the U.S. government had created a new program. It permitted the orphaned children of American soldiers, like Tum, to come to the United States. And, the official explained, the child's immediate family could come too. Tum did not believe the official. He was afraid the Vietnamese government was trying to trick him. So he fled to Pleiku to find his adopted mother. The two confirmed that the program, called the Amerasian Homecoming Act, was real. But then his adopted mother did something surprising. She sold Tum to another family. In return, she received about 56 grams of gold. Yet Tom's new family did not succeed in joining him in the United States. At the age of 19, Tum left Vietnam alone. He was, again, all by himself.
Janice also came to the United States through the Amerasian Homecoming Program. But she came with her mother and a stepsister. They were all searching for her father. Saul was a soldier working at an American base in Tam Quang. He and Win Ti Chin lived together for 4 years before Chin gave birth to a baby girl named Janice. 4 months later, Saul was ordered to withdraw from Vietnam. He promised to return for Janice and her mother. He even sent letters and money. But when guerrilla forces entered Bien Hoa in 1972, Janice and her mother fled. To protect her daughter, Shin destroyed all evidence of Saul. She burned his letters and photos. She tried to straighten her daughter's curly hair. She claimed Janny's father was a dark-skinned Montagnard instead of a black American. Eventually, Chin moved back to her parents' home in central Vietnam. They settled near Tam Quang on Highway 1. Janny's was 5.
Janny said, "I got beat up every day. They said, I'm from the enemy. They said, I'm not supposed to be here, and I'm not supposed to go to school." Others called her degrading terms for mixed race. They said her mother slept with her father for money. These insults were common for mixed race children. Throughout Vietnam, the children were ostracized because they looked different. People called them Bui Dai, meaning dust of life. Janice learned to deal with the insults. She did not have a choice. Then she learned about the U.S. government's program for mixed-race children. Chin, Janice, and a stepsister were accepted. They were invited to move to the American state of Oklahoma. For 18 years, Janice had been waiting for Saul to bring her to the U.S. Finally, she was going. But it was the U.S. government, not her father, that was bringing her.
Moki, Tan, and Janice have these things in common. They are of mixed race. They now live in the United States. And they are all using DNA tests to search for their American families. Moki wants to investigate her connections so she can understand her medical history. She found evidence of a genetic link to a person in Alabama who appears to be a cousin. But she has not located a closer relative. The search is painfully slow. But for now, she is pleased that her daughter is healthy again. Tom had a more fruitful experience. He found a close genetic match to a man from the state of Georgia named Chris Murray. Murray is Tom's uncle. He explained that his brother, Danny, was Tom's father. Danny was based in Thuy Hoa during the Vietnam War. But he died in 1989 in an automobile accident. Tom cried when he told the story. He said, "I've spent 43 years looking for my father, and he's no longer alive when I found him." Tom still wanted to recognize the connection to his American family. He changed his name to Thomas Danny Murray to honor his father and paternal grandfather.
Janice has had the least success in discovering her American family. She still has not found Saul, but she has developed a deep relationship with the mixed-race, dust-of-life community. On a Saturday afternoon in November, Janice was at an airport motel in Oklahoma City. Almost everyone else in the area was watching a television broadcast of an American football game. But not Janice. she was rehearsing traditional Vietnamese songs with 60 other Dust of Life. They were performing that night for a fundraiser. The money would help others who were still left behind. Two of the Vietnamese-American orphans were singing. Janice stopped to listen to the words. "I was born fatherless. My mother abandoned me when I was just an infant. Nobody cares about my life. No one shows mercy to the biracial child. There is only me on my own." Janice looked around her at the other abandoned children. "This is my family," she said. "These are my brothers and sisters. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly."
And I'm Brian Lynn.
Now, we go to Mars with science correspondent Ann Ball.
Pictures of the planet Mars show a rocky, lifeless scene. It is hard to imagine plants or animals could ever exist there. But scientists continue to look for evidence. NASA, America's space agency, has found evidence that a long time ago there was surface water on the red planet. Scientists believe water is necessary to support life as we know it. So, since that discovery, they have been looking for chemicals that would be present if there once was, or still is, life on the planet. At a December 13th conference in California, NASA scientists reported a breakthrough. They said for the first time that they had found very small amounts of an interesting element. It is called boron. John Grotzinger is the lead scientist for Curiosity, the space vehicle on Mars that is exploring the planet.
We have an instrument called the chemistry camera, which has made a detection of boron. And boron is interesting because in some scenarios for the origin of life, boron is able to help catalyze some of the reactions that build materials that eventually could become part of RNA molecules.
In other words, a camera on Mars showed the element boron. Boron is important because it could help build RNA molecules. And RNA molecules are important because they are one of the essential building blocks for life. One of the next steps in the scientists' search for life on Mars comes in 2020. That year, the next spacecraft is scheduled to launch. It will send rocks from Mars back to Earth. Scientists in Britain are getting ready for those Mars rocks now. Using a powerful microscope, they have already examined 200 million-year-old volcanic rocks found deep in the Pacific Ocean. The microscope revealed holes made by tiny living things called microbes. Microbes are the oldest form of life on Earth. They are only the size of one cell. Peter Cumpson works with Newcastle University.
What we've been able to do is look in detail at the carbon chemistry within those tiny structures and identify that as being the remnants of some form of life, probably fungal related.
Next, the scientists in Britain will examine meteorites formed from ancient material from Mars. The material comes from a time when Mars would have been more likely to sustain life. Graham Purvis explains what they will be looking for in the material. He is a geoscientist with Newcastle University.
What we intend to do is have a look at some of the rocks that may be available from NASA, which date back to a time when Mars was much warmer and wetter, and have a look at some of the structures and chemical signatures that we see in those rocks.
The scientists hope to find tiny microbe holes in the ancient material similar to the ones they saw in the ocean rocks. If they do, they predict that the rocks coming directly from Mars will also show signs of life. That, in turn, could finally prove that we are not alone. I'm Anne Ball.
Thanks, Anne. Now we present The Making of a Nation with Steve Ember.
Dwight Eisenhower was elected president in 1952. By 1960, Eisenhower had served two terms. The Constitution was changed to prevent presidents from being elected more than twice after Franklin Roosevelt won four times. The delegates who attended the presidential nominating convention in the summer of 1960 feared that their party would lose the election in November. They had to find the strongest candidate possible. Many believed that Richard Nixon was the strongest. Nixon had been a senator and a member of the House of Representatives. He had been Eisenhower's vice president for 8 years. When Eisenhower suffered several serious illnesses, Nixon had a chance to show his abilities to lead the nation. He showed great strength while facing an angry crowd during a trip to South America. He also gained support when he defended the United States to Khrushchev during a trip to the Soviet Union. Nixon's closest opponent for the Republican nomination was Nelson Rockefeller. Rockefeller was the governor of New York State. He came from one of the richest families in America. Richard Nixon easily won the support of the party. The delegates nominated him on the first vote. He accepted the nomination, and he called for new efforts for peace and freedom around the world. The race for the Democratic nomination was much more difficult. The Democratic Party thought it would have no problem winning the presidential election. Many candidates entered the race for the nomination. One was Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota. Another was Senator John Kennedy of Massachusetts. Humphrey had been elected to the Senate three times. He was a strong activist for civil rights and peace. Kennedy was a Navy hero in World War II. He was handsome and only 43 years old. He was also Roman Catholic. No Catholic had ever been elected president of the United States. Kennedy and Humphrey began to compete in state primary elections, the first step in the nominating process. Kennedy won an important primary in Wisconsin. But voters in Protestant areas of that state did not support him. The question then became, could he win in another state, West Virginia? Most of the voters in that state were Protestant. On the last night of the primary campaign in West Virginia, Kennedy spoke about his religion. He said, "The President of the United States promises to defend the Constitution." And that, he said, includes the separation of the government from any religion or church. Kennedy won a big victory in West Virginia. He then went on to win many votes in other primaries. He received the nomination on the first vote at the Democratic Convention. In his acceptance speech, he said he would ask Americans to help their country and sacrifice for their country. After the party conventions, the two candidates, Kennedy and Nixon, began to campaign around the country. Nixon charged that Kennedy was too young to be president. He said Kennedy did not know enough about governing. Kennedy attacked the Republican record of the past 8 years. He said President Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon had not done enough to bring progress to the nation. Protestant groups expressed concerns about Kennedy's religion. They wondered if he would be influenced by the Pope. They wondered if the leader of the Roman Catholic Church would try to make policy for the United States. Kennedy answered by repeating his strong support for the constitutional separation of church and state. Public opinion surveys showed the election campaign to be very close. Then the candidates agreed to hold 4 debates on television. In the first debate, the candidates showed they did not differ too widely on major issues. Kennedy appeared calm and sure, but Nixon did not feel well. He appeared thin and tired. Many people who had not considered voting for Kennedy now began to change their minds. To them, he looked more presidential. Most people seemed to feel that Kennedy won the first debate. Nixon probably won the second one. And both men did about the same in the last 2. In the 4th debate, they expressed widely different opinions about whether the United States was making progress. Kennedy believed there had been little progress under Eisenhower and Nixon.
Franklin Roosevelt said in 1936 that generation of Americans had a rendezvous with destiny. I believe in 1960 and 61 and 2 and 3, we have a rendezvous with destiny. And I believe it incumbent upon us to be the defenders of the United States and the defenders of freedom. And to do that, we must give this country leadership and we must get America moving again.
Nixon disagreed. He believed the United States had not been standing still, but there was more to be done.
It is essential, with the conflict that we have around the world, that we not just hold our own, that we not keep just freedom for ourselves. It is essential that we extend freedom, extend it to all the world. And this means more than what we've been doing. It means keeping America even stronger militarily than she is. It means seeing that our economy moves forward even faster than it has. It means making more progress in civil rights than we have, so that we can be a splendid example for all the world to see.
Another issue in the 1960 presidential debates was the Chinese attack on the islands of Quemoy and Matsu in the Taiwan Strait. And another was how to deal with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. After the debates, the presidential candidates campaigned around the country again. Nixon proposed that if he were elected, he would travel to Eastern Europe and meet with Khrushchev. Kennedy proposed the Peace Corps, a program to send Americans to developing countries to provide technical aid and other help. On Election Day in November, the voters chose John Kennedy as their 35th president. His victory, however, was a close one. Almost 69 million people voted. Kennedy won by fewer than 120,000 votes. The beginning of his presidency will be our story next Sunday. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from The Voice of America.